Agatha. Danbury House, just outside the sitting room. 25th of April, 1762. She had to get rid of the Queen. Now. Yesterday, if possible. Agatha very carefully shut the doors behind her. The entrance hall looked somehow both smaller and grander with the assortment of royal guards who had accompanied the Queen. They took up a great deal of space, but their bright red livery was unmistakably regal. She saw Coral rushing toward her, dozens of questions in her eyes. Putting a finger to her lips, Agatha jerked her head to the side. They needed to speak where they would not be overheard. "Her Majesty means to stay," Agatha whispered.
"Stay?"
Coral gushed.
"What an honour!"
"No, it is not an honour," Agatha snapped back. "It is terrifying. She's with child, with royal child. She quite literally contains the future of the British Empire in her womb. I cannot be responsible for her."
"But even for an afternoon?"
"She's not talking about an afternoon. She wants to take up residence in one of our guest rooms."
"Oh."
Coral was entranced. "Stop. Now." Agatha gave her maid a stern look. Stern and petrified. Stern and petrified and panicked. "This cannot happen. Do you understand me? I would be harbouring a..."
"Queen?"
Coral supplied helpfully. "She is asking me to commit treason, Coral."
"Oh, my."
Coral frowned.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, I'm sure." No, she wasn't sure. But she was sure that treason was whatever the palace decided it was. And keeping the Queen against their wishes would not be looked upon with kindness.
"What would you like me to do?"
Coral asked. "Send a footman to Buckingham House. Now." Coral raced off. Agatha eyed the doors to the drawing room with trepidation. What should she do? Go back in? Wait outside? She told the Queen she'd send tea and biscuits, but she'd already sent Coral away, and she dared not leave this spot to ask the cook to prepare a plate. She grabbed a chair and shoved it up in front of the drawing room doors, smiled at the guards, sat down, folded her arms. She was not moving from this spot. The fate of a nation depended on it. 20 minutes later, Brimsley arrived with a handsome, dark-skinned man who was introduced to her as the Queen's brother, Duke Adolphus of Mecklenburg-Strelitz. "She's in the drawing room," Agatha said, unsure of to which man she should address her comments. They both charged forward. She held up a hand.
"Perhaps I should announce you, to smooth the way."
She scooted the chair to the side and slipped back into the drawing room, shutting the door behind her.
"Were you going to send tea?" the Queen asked.
She was slouched on Agatha's settee, looking exhausted in that way only another woman who had been pregnant could understand.
"My apologies," Agatha told her.
"I quite forgot. But I must inform you that your man, Brimsley, is here."
"So bloody good at his job," the Queen muttered.
"Your brother is here as well." "I will not see them," the Queen stated.
Agatha cleared her throat, working out how best to proceed.
"Your Majesty, I do not pretend to know what problems await you outside. However, I do know that they will not be solved in here."
"They will not be solved anywhere," Charlotte told her. Agatha let out a shaky sigh.
"Would you care to tell me what troubles you?"
"Very much, but I cannot. I cannot tell anyone. All I can say is that I have been lied to and betrayed by everyone in this country but you. You are my only friend."
But she was not. Agatha had not been a friend to Charlotte.
She had sold her secrets to Princess Augusta for the price of this house, admission to White's for Lord Danbury, and now possibly for the succession rights for her son. She had betrayed Charlotte in every way possible.
Your Majesty, Agatha said, taking a seat across from her.
I am not your friend, but I want to be. However, at this moment, I am purely your subject, and I have been acting as your subject, not considering your feelings. I have made you into a crown instead of letting you have your humanity, and I am sorry. She did not know if she would tell Charlotte what she had done. She did not know if anything could be gained by retroactive honesty, but she vowed that she would do better.
If we are to be friends, we need to start again, Agatha said, because I very much need a friend too.
Charlotte stared at her for a very long time, and then finally, in a voice that belonged to a girl, not a queen, she said,
You will be my friend.
Agatha nodded gratefully.
I will be your friend.
Charlotte took her hand and squeezed it.
This is not the life I wished for. I can see that you are most unhappy.
What would you advise me to do? Agatha chose her words carefully.
I cannot advise unless I understand your situation.
Charlotte's mouth trembled, but her eyes were steady when she said, I will have your discretion.
You will, Agatha vowed.
The king, he is... 100 things went through Agatha's mind in under a second. None of them was what Charlotte finally said. He is... ill.
What?
Agatha gasped. Is he dying?
No,
Charlotte assured her. It is not like that. His illness is... in his head. Agatha's eyes grew wide. She could not even bring herself to reply. Not all the time, Charlotte hastily added. Most of the time, or at least most of the time that I have seen him, he is quite sane. But then... once... She caught her lower lip between her teeth. It was terrifying. Agatha leaned forward.
I must ask, did he hurt you?
No, Charlotte said, and Agatha thanked the heavens that she did so firmly and without hesitation.
No,
Charlotte said again, and I do not think he ever would. But when he was like that, he did not know me. I do not think he knew himself.
And no one told you of this before you married him, Agatha surmised.
Charlotte shook her head, and her voice grew brittle.
It was why they chose me.
She motioned to her face, to her beautiful brown skin. They thought I would be so grateful for the position that I would overlook his peculiarities.
Peculiarities?
Charlotte let out a grim snort. That is what Princess Augusta likes to call it. It hardly seems sufficient.
I'm not sure.
Agatha had so many questions, but how did one press for details? It was probably treasonous just to inquire. I have only seen it happen once, Charlotte said. I was asleep, and I awoke to him talking nonsense about the stars and the sky, and honestly, I do not know what else. Agatha squeezed Charlotte's hand. She had no words. A gesture would have to do. He was writing on the walls and repeating numbers. I think he was trying to make sense of some mathematical equation, and then he... She looked up, her eyes pleading. You promise me. You promise you will say nothing.
I vow on the lives of my children.
He ran outside and tore off his clothing. Agatha gasped. She could not help it. He started shouting at the sky. He thought I was Venus.
Dear God,
Agatha whispered.
Who witnessed this?
Me, Brimsley, although only part of it, and Reynolds, the king's man. I think he knows more than anyone.
What did you do?
Charlotte gave a sad shrug. We brought him back inside, Reynolds and I. We washed him, put him to bed. He was so tired. He fell asleep instantly. And then the next day...
Agatha leaned forward.
He was gone.
Gone?
Charlotte nodded. He went to Kew. I have not seen him since.
Agatha tried to absorb all of this. How long has it been?
More than 2 months.
What?
Agatha was not expecting that. He has been at Kew this entire time. I remain at Buckingham House. Alone. Charlotte let out a bitter laugh. Well, as alone as one can be with a flotilla of staff and Princess Augusta. Mein Gott, that woman is everywhere.
Agatha nodded.
She had been to the palace. It was clear the queen had no real privacy.
Is the king receiving treatment?
She asked. Yes, there is a doctor. I met him once. I do not like him. I could not tell you why. It was just a sense I had.
Is he improving?
Charlotte shrugged helplessly. I do not know. No one will tell me anything. I write him letters, but I receive no replies. I can only assume he is not getting better. Surely someone would have told me if he were. Agatha sat back, taking a moment to steady herself. What the Queen had just told her, it had the potential to bring down the monarchy, the government, their very way of life.
Who knows about this?
She asked. His mother, of course.
Of course, Agatha thought, acerbically.
Lord Bute, Earl Harcourt. But I do not think the three of them are aware of the severity. They did not see him that night.
Charlotte, Agatha said. I may call you Charlotte.
She had called her Charlotte before, but somehow it seemed right to ask this time. Charlotte nodded.
What do you want?
Charlotte looked at her blankly, as if it had never occurred to her that her opinions mattered, that she had a voice in the outcome. No one has ever asked me that, she said.
Do you want to leave?
Agatha asked.
Because you can't. Surely you know that. But is that even what you really want?
No, Charlotte said. I'm not even sure why I came here today. It was only that... She shook her head, and it seemed to Agatha that she was only just now truly considering the question.
There are things you cannot do,
Agatha advised her.
You cannot leave the country. You cannot divorce the king. But you can, if you want, live apart from him.
Not here, she added quickly. That is what I have been doing, Charlotte said. He is at Kew, and I am at Buckingham.
But is it what you want?
Agatha had met the king but twice. First, at his wedding, when they had exchanged barely a dozen words, and then at the Danbury Ball, when he had changed the world by asking her to dance. It was impossible to judge a man on 2 meetings, but Agatha felt in her bones that he was a good man, a decent man, and clearly a troubled one, too.
Charlotte,
she said, taking both of the younger woman's hands in hers.
What sort of man is the king?
Tell me about him. The man he truly is, when he is himself. Charlotte's lips trembled into a smile. He is funny, and he is kind, and he is so very intelligent. I did not expect... I know that many think the royals are simply bumbling idiots born into their roles, but he is truly clever. He has a giant telescope. Have you ever seen one of those? No, of course you wouldn't have. He has the only one in Britain. Agatha watched Charlotte closely. She was like a different person when she talked about her husband. When she talked about him as a man, not as their king. He sees me, Charlotte said. He sees me. For me. Not just for what I represent or this baby I carry in my body. He asks my opinion. Did you know that before the wedding he said I could leave if I wanted to? There we were, with my brother and... Oh, Himmel! She looked toward the door. Is he still in the hall? He can wait, Agatha said. This was much more important. I tried to escape before the wedding, Charlotte said, a look of mischievous glee sparking in her eyes. I knew it. What? How? I saw you, up in the balcony, and everything was running so late. I knew something was amiss. Agatha leaned forward. This had turned into a wonderful woman-to-woman chat, and it was clear they were both desperate for the connection. Forget about that. Tell me what happened.
I tried to climb the garden wall.
You didn't.
I did. I mean, I tried. I didn't succeed. And then George came out, and I didn't know who he was, and I asked him to help me go over the wall.
Agatha shrieked with laughter.
I know, Charlotte exclaimed.
There was a knock on the door.
Is everything all right in there?
Came the German accented voice of Charlotte's brother. Wait one moment, Agatha said. She scurried over to the door and poked her head out. We need a bit more time.
We don't have time,
Duke Adolphus replied. Agatha looked at him impassively. Why not?
Because...
He looked at Brimsley, who shrugged.
I suppose we do have time, he said, as long as she returns to the palace.
She will, Agatha said, but right now she needs a friend. She shut the door on Duke Adolphus's stunned face and returned to Charlotte's side. What happened next? She asked eagerly.
We talked, and he was very charming.
Agatha nodded. He is very charming. I danced with him, remember?
Yes, of course.
Anyway, then Adolphus came out and he was horrified. Agatha laughed.
I can just imagine.
And then George said that I was deciding whether or not I wanted to marry him, and Adolphus said something like, of course she's going to marry you. And then George said, no, she's still deciding. It's entirely up to her. Agatha thought that was the most romantic thing she'd ever heard.
I think I might love him, Charlotte whispered.
Then you need to fight for him. Charlotte looked up sharply. I said that to him once. I asked him to fight for me.
Perhaps he is trying, Agatha said, in his own way.
Charlotte's eyes took on a sad, pensive look.
I will never understand his way. No one will.
Agatha had no idea what to say to that.
But I have not even asked about you, Charlotte suddenly said. I know it has been many months, but you are still mourning a great loss. And the children, is there anything I can do?
Agatha's lips parted. Her heart stopped. There was so much Charlotte could do. She could wave her hand, and all of Agatha's troubles would disappear. Dominic would become Lord Danbury in truth. 1,000 heads of cattle would be relocated to the Danbury lands, and suddenly there would be income. And yet, Agatha could not ask. Not when she had vowed to be nothing but a friend.
This, she said firmly, this
is all I need. Spending time with a friend. It helps so much.
Wonderful, Charlotte said, with that unique smile of hers. Now, I have asked the royal physician, and he says getting a baby out of me shall be quick and painless. You have babies. Tell me, does it hurt?
Having children is the worst pain imaginable.
I knew it. Charlotte's head snapped up. Wait, really? Agatha saw the queasiness in her eyes and gave a little laugh.
No, it only hurts a little, she lied. And you will hardly remember it once it is over.
Oh, Charlotte sighed. Good.
You have nothing to worry about, Agatha assured her.
Except for my brother outside the door and my husband over at Kew doing God knows what with that doctor. Agatha reached forward and took Charlotte's hands.
We are women, she said, and the men who hold our fates hardly conceive that we have desires and dreams of our own. If we are ever to live the lives we want, we have to make them conceive it. Our bravery, the force of our will, shall be their proof.
Yes, Charlotte said. Just that. Just yes. She stood up. So did Agatha. I will never be able to thank you publicly for what you have done for me today, Charlotte said, for how you have helped me. But please know that in my heart, I will always be grateful. Humbled, Agatha curtsied.
Your Majesty.
Charlotte bid her to rise. Right now, to you, just Charlotte. At that, she walked to the door and opened it. The moment she stepped into the hall, she changed. Her posture, her mien, the very look in her eye. She was no longer Charlotte. She was the Queen. Brother, she said, how nice of you to come and fetch me. The Duke's temper was clearly frayed. Charlotte, you cannot. She cut him off with an upraised hand and turned to Agatha. Please thank your household for their hospitality, Lady Danbury.
I will, Your Majesty.
As Agatha watched her cross the hall to the front door, Duke Adolphus made his way to her side.
May I thank you too, Lady Danbury, for your discretion and grace.
Anything for Her Majesty, Agatha said. She meant it.
But then Charlotte stopped. She crossed back to Agatha and took her hand.
Strength, she seemed to say.
Agatha squeezed back.
Strength.
I am ready, Charlotte said. Agatha followed them to the door, Charlotte escorted by her brother, Brimsley, 5 paces behind.
A queen's first responsibility is not to her whim, but to her people,
Agatha heard Adolphus say. Poor Charlotte, lectured at already.
Queens immemorial have shouldered that burden before you, he continued, and you shall fare no worse than them. In time, you will grow to love your noble responsibilities. It is the natural outgrowth of your noble character.
Charlotte stopped walking.
Charlotte?
Her brother said. She just stood there. Agatha tried not to gape. Brimsley, Charlotte said. He was at her side in a heartbeat. She turned back to Adolphus. You will need to find your own way back to Buckingham House. Perhaps Lady Danbury will lend you her carriage.
What are you talking about? We have only just retrieved you. Where are you off to now?
You sold me off to be the Queen of England. Charlotte stood tall. I am off to be the Queen of England. On the outside, Lady Agatha Danbury was the epitome of grace and dignity, quietly directing her footman to have a carriage prepared for the German Duke.
But on the inside, oh, how she cheered.
Charlotte. Q Palace. The Entrance Drive. 25th of April, 1762. Charlotte's feet had barely touched the ground before she was striding away from the carriage. It was time to be queen. "Where is the king?" she demanded. Reynolds came rushing over. She tried to remind herself that he was a good man, that he cared deeply for George's welfare. But just then, all she could see was an infuriating obstacle. He bowed, then said, "I am so sorry, Your Majesty, but the king cannot see you now." "Nonsense. Take me to him."
"Your Majesty, there is nothing more I would like than—"
"She needs to see him," Brimsley cut in sharply. "It is her right." Reynolds looked torn.
"I wish I could."
But just then, another man came running out, wiping his hands on a rag. It was that doctor, the one she did not like.
"Your Majesty," he said,
his voice deep and authoritative. "I am sorry you have bothered yourself to make such a trip, but I am afraid it is impossible for you to see the king."
Charlotte held her ground. "It is perfectly possible. I want to see him. Where is he?"
"No," the doctor said dismissively. "Your Majesty would not want that."
Charlotte had to force herself to maintain her queenly composure. What she really wanted was to go for the man's throat. "Do not tell me what I want, doctor. Now show me to him, or I shall have my men search the entire palace." The doctor's jaw hardened, and he took a step. It was a small motion, but it was clear that his intention was to block her way. Charlotte turned to Reynolds. "What is his name?"
"Dr. Monroe, Your Majesty."
"Dr. Monroe," she said, each syllable cut like a diamond. "I am your queen." Still, he did not budge. And then Reynolds moved between them, turning his back most pointedly on the doctor.
"Come with me, Your Majesty. I will lead you to the king."
"No," Dr. Monroe protested. "You cannot. My work. We are at a most precarious point." Charlotte ignored him. She and Brimsley followed Reynolds through the palace, past the glorious public rooms, past the comfortable private rooms. Down a long hall they went, finally arriving at a rather unassuming door. Monroe followed the entire way, spewing a non-stop torrent of dire warning. "Someone shut that man up," Charlotte muttered.
"Do not open that door,"
Monroe raged. Charlotte shoved it open and walked straight into hell. There were cages on every surface, some open, some with sad little animals inside. None big enough for a human, thank God. But what were they even doing there? And blood. There was blood. Not a lot of it, but splatters here and there, along with terrible yellow stains on the floor. Chairs were overturned. Grotesque metal instruments were strewn about. Whips. Chains. And in the center of it all, strapped into a monstrous iron chair, was George. He moaned incoherently and his head lolled, his hair sticking to his forehead in sweaty clumps. There were bruises on his body, angry red welts, and he was so thin, so desperately, agonizingly thin. "My God," Charlotte breathed. She could not have imagined. She could never have imagined. The doctor's assistants did not see her enter. So intent were they on their work. Even though George had been securely tied to the chair, one was still bracing his shoulders as the other pressed a hot poker into his skin. George screamed in agony. So did Charlotte.
"Untie him,"
she said, barely able to choke out the words. The assistants looked to the doctor for confirmation.
"Untie the king,"
she roared.
They rushed to undo the knots at his hands. Brimsley and Reynolds worked at the ones at his feet. It seemed to take forever. Charlotte looked around for a knife. Her eyes had just landed on one when Brimsley got the last knot undone, and George was finally freed of his bonds. He burst from the chair and ran to her, sobbing, clinging to her shoulders.
"Everyone out!" Charlotte yelled. "Now!"
Monroe and his assistants fled, but Reynolds and Brimsley were hesitant to move.
"Are you sure, Your Majesty?" Brimsley asked. "He is most overwrought and stronger than you are."
"I am sure."
But even as she said it, George was pushing her against the wall.
"No, yes, Farmer George,"
he whimpered. He buried his face in the crook of her neck as his mumblings grew incoherent. Brimsley rushed to her side.
"He is too strong. I cannot leave you alone with him."
"It's all right. It's all right." Charlotte craned her neck so she could look over George's shoulder at Brimsley.
"He is just trying to get away from that damnable chair. Now go. Please."
He and Reynolds exited the room. Charlotte had every expectation that they would remain 5 paces away.
"Nobody, nobody. I'm nobody, but I'll try, I'll try, I'll try, I will."
His hands gripped her shoulders, and his eyes were frantic.
"I'll try, I'll try, just make it stop. I'll try, I'll do it, I'll do it." "George, stop,"
Charlotte pleaded. This was nothing like when he'd run wildly under the stars. This was a man in pain. He was utterly lost, nearly broken.
"No,"
he pleaded. He shook his head fast, faster.
"No, no, I'll do it, I'll do it. I didn't."
"George," Charlotte said sternly. "Look, George, it is me." His eyes darted all over her face.
"Venus," she tried. "Venus is here, George."
Still, he did not recognize her. He clung to her. He pleaded with her. But he did not recognize her.
"Oh, damn Venus," she swore. "I am Charlotte. I am Charlotte, and I need you to be George again. I need you to try."
She grabbed his face in her hands, trying to stop the shaking.
"You are just George, and I am just Charlotte. Come back to me. Please, George. Come back."
He whimpered. Words came whispering from his mouth, but she could not understand them. Desperate, she grabbed one of his hands and placed it on her belly.
"Do you feel that, George? It kicks. It grows. It is ours."
He seemed to grow quieter, and the frantic darting of his eyes began to slow and calm.
"I am Charlotte," she said yet again. "And this is our child, and we need you to be George, or none of us is anyone."
His fingers curled around hers, and he looked up.
"Charlotte," he whispered. "Charlotte."
"Yes,"
she whispered. She nodded jerkily, and all the tears she swore she could not cry began to roll down her cheeks.
"I am with you,"
she promised.
"I am here, and I will never leave you again."
"I was just trying to be good," he whimpered. "I was just trying to be well."
"And you will be, but not like this."
He nodded, but in his eyes she saw a scared child.
What had they done to him? How could she have allowed it to happen?
"That doctor will never come near you again," she vowed. "I promise you."
"I want to be well."
He touched her cheek, almost as if he were reassuring himself that she was really there.
"I want to be well for you."
"You will be,"
she said. But she had no idea if her words were true. Maybe he would always be ill in this way. She could not see into his mind. She could not reach in and mend whatever it was that caused him to lose himself.
But nothing could be worse than what Dr. Monroe had done. Charlotte might not be able to cure George, but she could certainly make him better than he was right now.
"What would you like to eat?" she said,
careful to keep her voice soft and gentle. "You are far too thin. Do you want something sweet? Savory?"
"Both."
He gave her a tiny quirk of a smile, and in it she saw a hint of the man she so adored.
"And a bath," she said,
trying not to wince at his odour. "We will see to that as well."
"Thank you."
She looked at his face closely. He still looked hollow, haunted, but maybe with the tiniest bit of hope. She held his hand as she went to the door and opened it. Reynolds and Brimsley were waiting just outside.
"Your Majesties," they both said instantly.
"Reynolds," Charlotte said, "would you please see to the king? He needs a bath and something small to eat while we arrange for a proper meal."
"Anything but gruel," George said to him,
and the two shared a look. Charlotte was grateful to witness that moment. It spoke of friendship. It spoke of humanity. She turned to George. "I will be back with you shortly. First, I have some important business to attend to." She waited while Reynolds led George away, then turned to Brimsley and said, "Come, we must deal with the doctor."
"Gladly, Your Majesty."
They strode back through the palace, unfortunately making one wrong turn before locating Dr. Monroe and his assistants in the drive in front of the building. The sun had begun to set, and the air was golden and shimmering with promise.
"You,"
Charlotte said ominously, pointing at the doctor,
"you will leave here and never return."
Dr. Monroe came striding over, his posture still that of a man who expected success.
"I apologize if Your Majesty..."
"Too close," Brimsley barked, stepping in front of the Queen.
The doctor took a step back.
"We were not expecting you, Your Majesty."
"Clearly," Charlotte said.
"You must understand, that was not the part of our treatment I would have preferred you to see."
"There are pretty parts to the treatment," Charlotte asked. "What would those be? The parts that gave him the welts, the bruises?"
"Your Maj—"
But she was not done.
"The part where you starved him,"
she continued, her voice growing dangerously brittle. Monroe brought his hands together, almost like a priest.
"Your Majesty must understand. While my methods are distressing, they are proven. I desire the king's sanity as fervently as Your Majesty does."
"I care not for his sanity,"
Charlotte retorted.
"I care for his happiness, his soul. Let him be mad if mad is what he needs."
"You are wrong,"
the doctor said.
"Watch yourself,"
Brimsley warned. Charlotte jabbed a finger toward the doctor.
"You are finished."
She turned to the guards, the same men who had accompanied her here. "Remove him from the grounds."
"This is an error,"
Dr. Monroe yelled.
"An error that will destroy him."
Charlotte whipped around to face him, seething.
"Be grateful that I do not order you destroyed."
She watched the guards pull him away. She took pleasure in it. And when she could no longer hear him howling his fury, she turned to Brimsley and said,
"I will need my things packed. Everything. We are moving to Kew."
Kew Palace. The observatory. An hour later. Charlotte had thought she'd find George in his suite of rooms, but she supposed it made sense that he and Reynolds would have gone to the observatory. It was where he was happiest. He was sitting at a table, freshly bathed and clothed, frantically eating the feast that had been laid out before him. Mutton, of course, warm rolls, his favourite scalloped potatoes. Q, too, had an orangery, and several oranges had been peeled, their sections fanned out for his enjoyment. A warm meal and a bath must be a balm, Charlotte said. You seem more yourself. You look better. He stared at her, his fork hovering between his plate and his mouth. Do you feel better? She asked. Slowly, he set down his fork.
You should not have come.
She swallowed. She should have known this would not be easy. But she kept her smile light and cheerful. I was most happy to come.
No.
He shook his head.
No. This was a mistake.
I am so sorry, my love. She started to walk toward him, but his forbidding expression caused her to stop. Still, she said, I should have come sooner, but do not fear. I shall remain by your side as we...
No, Charlotte.
He raised his voice. She wasn't sure where he found the energy to do so, but he stood and said clearly,
Listen to my words. You should not have come. I do not want you here.
She didn't believe him. She refused to believe him.
Go back to Buckingham House, he said. Please.
She did not speak. He was wrong. She knew it, and she only needed him to understand it too. Slowly, she walked toward him.
Do you hear me? I said go back to Buckingham House. That is where you live. That is where you belong.
Shaking, he thrust his arm out, pointing to the door.
Go!
Still, she did not obey. He rose, crossed the room to where she was standing, screamed,
I do not want you! I want never to see you! Leave! Get out!
No. His whole body shook.
I order you.
No. No, George.
Charlotte!
She stood steadfast. You cannot force me away. I will not go.
I command it. Go!
Finally, she roared.
I will stay! I command it!
George was stunned into silence, staring at her as she stalked toward him.
Please, Charlotte.
His voice had gone quieter, and it sounded as if it might crack.
Please go.
She said it again. No.
Charlotte, you are not listening.
I am. I have heard that you wish I had not come, that you want me to go, that you do not want to see me.
Then listen, he pleaded.
What I have not heard is that you do not love me. He went very still. I have been suffering and alone and believing I am a failure as a wife and as your queen because you stay away from me as though I am a disease. And then today, it quite suddenly occurred to me that perhaps there is another reason. A better reason. Perhaps you stay away from me because you care for me. Perhaps you stay away because you love me. She stepped closer. Do you love me?
I'm trying to protect you.
Do you love me?
He shook his head. I cannot. We cannot. This conversation is not...
She watched him with raised brows.
I cannot do this,
he said. She would not stand for that. Do you love me?
I never intended to marry, he said, shaking his head. I never wanted to...
Do you love me? She was relentless. She had to be.
Charlotte, please stop.
But his face was a picture of heartbreak. Maybe his heart had to be broken so that she could put it back together. Is it that you do not believe that I could love you? She asked. Because I do. I love you, George. I love you so much that I will do as you wish. He opened his mouth to speak, but she held up a hand and said, "If you do not love me." She felt the sudden need to move, to rock the baby growing within her. So she walked the few steps to the window and looked out. "All that you have to say is that you do not love me, and I will go." She turned back around, her eyes meeting his with unflinching clarity. "I will go back to Buckingham House, and we can live our separate lives, and I will have this baby alone, and make do, and fill my days, and survive all on my own. I will do that. But first, you have to say that you do not love me. And then, you have to tell me that I am utterly alone in this world." His eyes searched hers. There was a heartbreaking tension to his body, as if he were afraid he'd shatter. Or maybe, as if he was poised and coiled, preparing for escape. Finally, when the silence stretched taut, he said,
"I am a madman. I am a danger."
She shook her head.
"No. Listen. Inside my mind, there are other worlds creeping in. The heavens and the earth collide, and I do not know where I am."
Charlotte asked the only question that mattered. "Do you love me?"
"That does not signify," he said. "You do not wish a life with me for yourself. No one wishes that."
She was so sick of men telling her what she wanted, especially now, when her very heart was at stake. "George," she implored, "I will stand with you, between the heavens and the earth. I will tell you where you are."
"Charlotte, you..."
"Do you love me?"
she practically cried.
And there it was. She was begging. She had laid herself bare, given him her pride and her heart and everything she was, and...
"I love you."
The words sounded as if they'd been ripped from his soul. He'd been holding this back, denying his own heart. She could see it in his eyes as they filled with tears. "George," she whispered.
"No, let me finish. From the moment I saw you trying to go over the wall, I have loved you desperately. I cannot breathe when you are not near. I love you, Charlotte."
He took her face in his hands.
"My heart calls your name."
His kiss was one of love and hunger and desperation. He kissed her as if he could not get close enough, as if he could never get close enough, as if he would never let her go.
"I wanted to tell you," he said. "I wanted you to know, but this madness has been my secret my entire life. This darkness is my burden. You bring the light."
"George." She looked up at him, at his beloved face, those dark brows, and the full lower lip he liked to bite when he was amused. She knew him, she realized. She knew the man he was inside, and if sometimes that man was submerged under tortured waters, she could help him rise to the surface. She would not leave his side. "It is you and me," she vowed. "We can do this together."
Brimsley. Kew Palace, 8th of May, 1762. Brimsley decided he rather liked living at Kew. It was much more casual than Buckingham House, to whatever extent a royal residence could be called casual. He and Reynolds were treated like the most senior of servants, despite there being a butler and housekeeper. But most of all, Kew was delightful, because the king and queen were delightful, and delighted with each other. The first few days were difficult, though. It took time for the king to recover from his ordeal. Brimsley would never profess to know much about medicine. But he did not understand how anyone might think that torturing the king would help set his mind at ease. He was also beginning to realize the strain that Reynolds had been under, caring for the king while keeping all of this a secret. That first night, when the queen had so magnificently dispatched Dr. Monroe, Brimsley had tried to offer his assistance. But Reynolds was so used to bearing his burden alone, he found it difficult to accept help. Once the furore had died down and the king and queen had retired for the night, Brimsley and Reynolds had gone for a walk and found themselves in the stables. It was raining lightly, and so they'd gone inside to keep dry. It didn't smell as bad as Brimsley had feared. Clearly, the stable hands were excellent at whatever it was they had to do to keep the place fresh. The two men found a place to sit, leaning against a bale of hay. Reynolds sighed. Brimsley did not think he had ever seen him so tired.
"Have I ever told you how I came by this job?" Reynolds said.
Brimsley tipped his head, letting the side of his forehead kiss against Reynolds's shoulder.
"I imagine you were marked from a young age for your unmatched unction and superciliousness."
Reynolds gave him a little smirk, but there was a hint of good nature to it.
"The king and I grew up together. I was His Majesty's playmate. We fished and climbed trees and were boys together."
Brimsley nodded. Reynolds had mentioned this. Not often. He tended to be circumspect about his background.
"I'm still not sure why the palace allowed it," Reynolds continued. "They were monstrously strict about who got to spend time with the princes and princesses. I suppose it was because my mother was a trusted maid and my father a palace goldsmith. And I was the right age. Our birthdays are just 2 months apart."
"Who is the elder?" Brimsley asked.
"Me."
Reynolds gave him one of those smiles he loved so much.
"Of course.
Of course."
"There was no one else for him, unless some foreign dignitary or prince came to visit. But those were always awkward affairs. Two little boys dressed in their ridiculous finest and ordered to be friends."
"That does not sound as if it would go well."
"No," Reynolds mused. "It never did. Half the time they didn't even speak the same language. So it was just me. Me and George. I still called him George then."
"You don't now?"
Reynolds gave him a look.
"You know I don't. And I certainly never did when anyone else was around when we were children."
Brimsley chuckled.
"No, I can imagine that would not have gone over well.
Of course, I knew my station.
But I liked Georgie.
I liked him even when adults pushed me aside in their haste to bow and scrape to him."
Reynolds looked up and grinned. It was a sentimental sort of smile, with the barest hint of something sad.
"He was affable," he continued, "and full of good humour. He put on no airs. I was perhaps the first to recognise his peculiarities. But I liked him no less. I was the closest thing he had to a friend, so I kept his secret. I sang distracting songs when he lost control of his thoughts, held his arms down when they trembled."
He looked at Brimsley more directly.
"I hid him from his monstrous grandfather."
"That was good of you,"
Brimsley said, quietly. He had heard about George II. He had not been a kind man. Reynolds nodded slowly, the kind one did not when one is agreeing, but when one is remembering.
"When it came time to follow my father into the Goldsmiths Guild, I asked to stay with George instead. It would not be as lucrative, but I made the choice gladly, because he needed me, And because... He swallowed. Because he knew my secrets, too. My own peculiarity. And he did not care. He kept my secret as I kept his, as I had to. Even from you. I'm sorry I was so angry with you, Brimsley said. I would have been the same way, Reynolds admitted. It was just the Queen. I understand. It is my sworn duty to protect her. Reynolds gave him a little smile. It is my sworn duty to protect the King. What odd lives we lead, Brimsley mused. When do we get to protect ourselves? Or each other? Reynolds kissed him on the cheek. Hopefully every day. But we never come first. Brimsley faked a dramatic sigh. I suppose if I have to come second, it might as well be to the King. Reynolds chuckled, but he grew serious soon after. His secret is no longer just ours. I could not keep it. I tried. But first, there was his mother, and then Bute and Harcourt. Every damn chambermaid around here whispers of him now. Then that doctor. Reynolds grabbed Brimsley's hand, tightly. You understand now why I begged you to keep him away from the Queen. Yes, Brimsley said quickly. I cannot even imagine. It makes me sick even to think of it. His Majesty has suffered so much. I could not begin to describe it. The little I saw, Brimsley said. I tried to intervene, Reynolds said. I could have tried harder, I suppose. Brimsley could take it no more. He could not bear the pain in Reynolds's eyes. He just wanted to make it go away, even if only for a moment. Reaching up, he took his face in his hands and kissed him. Tenderly. With love. With a promise he did not know if he could keep. Q Palace. The Queen's Sitting Room. 1st of June, 1762. The Queen was doing embroidery, which Brimsley always found odd. He'd never thought she had the temperament for such a repetitive pastime, but she seemed to like it, and he liked that she liked it, especially since she had told him he could sit in a chair by the door rather than stand at attention the entire time. But then the King came bounding in, which meant that Brimsley most certainly had to rise to his feet. Reynolds arrived 5 paces behind and stood next to him. I am off to work in the fields, the King said. And indeed he was dressed for farm work, with none of his usual finery. We are cycling millet. He leaned down and gave the Queen a kiss on the top of her head. Would you like to join me? Never, she said with a chuckle. I shall stay here and grow our little king. He kissed his fingers, then touched her belly and made off to leave. George, the Queen suddenly called. I almost forgot. You received a letter. Where is it?
Right here,
Brimsley said, stepping forward. He retrieved it from a side table and handed it to the King.
It is from Princess Augusta.
My mother is writing to me. The King rolled his eyes and tossed the unopened letter into the fireplace. Brimsley didn't know whether he was horrified or delighted. But the King's happiness was certainly infectious. He strode back to the Queen and kissed her again.
You are beautiful, he proclaimed. My wife is beautiful.
And then off he went. Brimsley blinked. It was as if a whirling ball of sunshine had just rolled through the room. It had been some weeks since the Queen had rescued him from that horrendous doctor. But still, the difference was nothing short of miraculous. He turned to share a smile with Reynolds, who had not yet left to follow the King. But Reynolds
was regarding the Queen with a contemplative expression.
"Did you want to say something, Reynolds?" she asked.
"No, Your Majesty."
Brimsley watched the exchange with interest. Reynolds clearly wanted to say something. The Queen looked up from her embroidery to find Reynolds's eyes still on her.
"Speak," she said.
He cleared his throat.
"His Majesty has good days and down days."
"He did," the Queen replied. "But now that I am here, his days are good. He's better, is he not?"
"He is better now,"
Reynolds agreed. But his face told a different story. Brimsley knew him well enough to see the worry in his eyes.
"But," the Queen prodded, "perhaps caution would be..."
"Reynolds," she cut in, "let him be. All he needed was his wife and a routine and to get rid of that dreadful doctor. He's well."
Reynolds did not look convinced, but he bowed and said,
"Of course, Your Majesty."
"Will you accompany him to the fields?" she asked.
"Yes, Your Majesty. I enjoy cycling millet above all things."
Brimsley choked on a laugh. The Queen gave Reynolds a sly look.
"You are a good man, Reynolds."
"Thank you, Your Majesty."
"Enjoy your millet."
"Yes, Reynolds," Brimsley said.
"Enjoy your millet."
Reynolds gave him such a scowl on the way out that even the Queen laughed. Brimsley sat back down in his chair by the door and smiled.
This was how life ought to be.
Kew Palace, Reynolds's quarters, later that night. It was late, and the King and Queen had both retired, which meant that Brimsley and Reynolds were, theoretically, off duty. As Reynolds had a full-sized tub, that was where they had chosen to spend the evening. It was a perfect end to a lovely day.
"Do you think it will last?" Brimsley asked.
"What do you mean?"
"The King. Will he stay as he is?"
"One can hope," Reynolds said cryptically.
He started lathering Brimsley's back.
It was heavenly. "Reynolds?"
"Hmm?"
"If it lasts, they would have one another. They would be together, have a true marriage, grow old as one."
Reynolds poured water on Brimsley's back, rinsing off the suds.
"We would serve them together,"
Brimsley said quietly.
"A lifetime," Reynolds murmured.
It was the sort of thing men like them never dared to dream of. Like the King and Queen, they too would be together. Have a true partnership, grow old as one. Brimsley turned so that he could see Reynolds's face.
He was so handsome, so noble.
The other servants liked to joke that he had the mien of a duke, and they weren't far off. Sometimes, Brimsley couldn't believe that a man like Reynolds had chosen to be with him. And then he reminded himself that Reynolds was lucky too. Brimsley might not have the face of an Adonis, but he was no troll. And more important, he was clever, and he was steadfast. He was a good man, and he knew his worth.
"Do you think it's possible?"
Brimsley asked. Reynolds nodded.
"I do not know. Perhaps great love can make miracles."
"It can."
"And maybe, God willing, it would